activity. In November, Human Rights Watch and Christosol, this is what you're talking about, released a report supported by your investigations lab titled You've Arrived in Hell, Torture and Other Abuses Against Venezuelans in El Salvador's Mega Prison, based on interviews with 40 of the men who are ultimately released from SECOT. Democracy Now! Spoke with the report's authors. This is Noah Bullock, executive director of Christosol.
One of the conclusions we make is that torture is institutionalized in Salvadoran prisons. It's a state policy. It's almost as if the prison guards operate on a protocol. It's impossible that this is the actions of bad guards or bad apples. People were subjected to beatings almost daily. Upon arrival, they were beaten. When they asked for food and water, they were beaten. When they asked for medical care on the way to the clinic, they were beaten. They were often denied food, water, clothing as a basic hygiene as a tool of punishment or reprisals. And in the case of the report, we also showed how the Venezuelans resisted and protested the beatings, but then were subjected again to more beatings. There was a punishment cell called the Island in their module, where a tiny space, a solitary confinement cell, where they were taken and beaten regularly. They would be deprived for hours of food and water, or in some cases days. And even, sadly, we were documented cases of sexual abuse. And it's important to note that the testimonies were consistent across 40 different individuals who gave testimonies. We were able to document and corroborate their testimonies with photographic evidence that was assessed by independent forensic experts.
So that was the head of Christosol, who worked with Human Rights Watch. And you can see our interviews with both Noah Bullock of Christosol and Juan Papier of Human Rights Watch at democracynow.org. Before their report in August, ProPublica and the Texas Tribune released a joint investigation that revealed how the Venezuelan men deported by the Trump administration say they endured those months of physical and mental abuse at SECOT. It included a video featuring three of the men who were held there: Juan Jose Ramos, Andre Blanco Bonilla, and Wilmer Vega Sandia. This is an excerpt.
Fear. Fear, 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 terror.
An officer from El Salvador got on board, and he said, either you get off the easy way or the hard way. How will you get off? We're not getting off. Oh, the hard way then. And they started hitting us with batons.
The prison director told us, welcome to hell, where you enter alive and leave dead.
They forced us to kneel against our will, beating us. There were many people screaming, asking for help, for mercy. The shackles were so tight, and they injured our ankles. Many were even bleeding because we were cutting ourselves with the shackles. They would say to us crudely, walk, you piece of... I remember telling an officer, I can't walk. If you loosen the shackles, I can cooperate, but I can't walk. I have a medical condition. I'm hypertensive. I was beaten to the point of fainting. They dragged me until we got to the cell block. Then they threw me down. My head hit the floor. I woke up and asked God, why am I here?
I felt like my world had collapsed. They started putting 10 to 15 people in each cell.
Yo considero que la cárcel del Seco no es una cárcel...
I believe the Seco prison is not a prison meant to hold inmates. There, I feel like we were treated like animals.
Food tastes like soap. It was shocking. The bathrooms were disgusting. They used the water we had to use the shower.
Sewage, black water pipes ran through the cells. Some people developed respiratory illnesses because of that. The walls were full of mold.
Sleeping on metal because the beds were iron. I said, how long are we going to survive this?
So those are three Venezuelan migrants who the Trump administration sent to Salvador's notorious SECOT prison. They were featured in the Texas Tribune ProPublica report in August, but they're very similar to the stories that were told in this 60 Minutes report. I mean, I just watched the 60 Minutes report, not because it aired on CBS, but because the contractor in Canada played the 60 Minutes report because they were sent it, because they're used to running the 60 Minutes, and it was before it was spiked by the CBS editor-in-chief, Barry Weiss. I want to read more from 60 Minutes producer Sharon Alfonsi's internal memo about the decision to hold the segment. She writes, "If the standard for airing a story becomes the government must agree to be interviewed, then the government effectively gains control over the 60 Minutes broadcast. We go from an investigative powerhouse to a stenographer for the state. These men risk their lives to speak with us. We have a moral and professional obligation to the sources who entrusted us with their stories. Abandoning them now is a betrayal of the most basic tenet of journalism, giving voice to the voiceless." Again, those are the words of Sharon Alfonsi in an internal memo responding to the spiking of her story. We're speaking to Alexa Koenig, who participated in the 60 Minutes report with her students at the Investigations Lab at the University of California, Berkeley. If you can talk about this tenet, giving voice to the voiceless, and what it means now that this story is out, it may be end up being the most viewed story in 60 Minutes history, precisely because CBS tried to kill it. And what this is teaching your students at UCal, at Cal.
What it's teaching our students at UC Berkeley is really the importance of rigorous reporting and really tight fact-checking. One of the gold standard for any investigation is to bring together physical evidence with testimonial evidence, so the stories of survivors in crisis and conflict, with documentary evidence, so the written reports and records that can actually be collated, now increasingly from digital spaces. I think what these students are doing is trying to bring that process deeper into the 21st century, pulling from social media and having advanced skills. We often now train journalists and others in basic fundamentals of digital open source investigation precisely because so much of people's lives today are lived online. I think they learned just how abundant the kinds of information is, even for something as locked down as a prison like CECOT, that there is always or almost always going to be information that circulates in these digital spaces, and that it could be an extraordinarily powerful way to help find the facts. What, again, I think was so important about the work that these students did was to bring that together with the incredible reporting that's been done by journalists, including at 60 Minutes. And I think when you get everything pointed in the same direction around the who, what, when, where, why, and how, and what people really experienced, you have a high degree of confidence that what you're getting at is the truth. And today, when there is so much noise circulating both online and off, to be able to get to that truth and have some common understanding of the facts of what is being done on behalf of the United States is a really important way, means for us to preserve democracy and ultimately fight for the rule of law.
Finally, there's a really interesting point in this 60 Minutes piece. It's the story of Kristi Noem going to El Salvador, standing in front of caged men, most of them all tattooed. Can you talk about what your students found? Who were those men?
Yes. So the implication by Kristi Noem standing in front of them was that these were the men from Venezuela that had been sent to El Salvador. But what you can tell from the tattoos and the types of tattoos on the men in the background is that these were almost certainly not the men from Venezuela who had been recently deported from the United States. These were likely Salvadoran gang members and others who were there for a backdrop, I think, for her particular presentation. So I think even just from that imagery and being able to pull together an understanding of who in what countries use tattoos as a symbol of who they are and their affiliations and who does not, became really powerful visual information to strongly suggest that these were not the men she was implying that they might be.
And I wanted to ask you finally about the significance of the breaking news just as the story broke, of the spiking of the story. Paramount Skydance announced that Larry Ellison, the founder of Oracle and the father of Paramount CEO David Ellison, who installed Barry Weiss as editor-in-chief at CBS, Larry Ellison will personally guarantee $40 billion in the company's hostile bid for Warner Brothers Discovery. This comes about a week after the board of Warner Brothers rejected Paramount's offer in favor of Netflix. So if you can talk about the significance of this, if Paramount were to take over, they would take over, is this correct, HBO and CNN as well?
One of the trends that I am concerned about is the concentration of ownership over media. We're seeing that with social media sites being purchased up. We're also seeing it with more traditional media. When so much of our ability to communicate out facts to the world is concentrated in a small number of people, and there's a squeezing of independent media and the ability to get independent perspectives and voices out more broadly, I think we're working with an information ecosystem that is highly dangerous for ensuring that there's a diversity of voices and perspectives that can be used to hold power to account and to strengthen the ways that we operate in society. We need that diversity. It's one of the hallmarks of America. And I think the ability to bring facts to the American people in ways that they can at least have a common basis of understanding for what's happening in the world.
Alexa Koenig, I want to thank you so much for being with us, for doing this first interview since the 60 Minutes piece was spiked with Democracy Now! Alexa Koenig is co-faculty director of the Human Rights Center at the University of California, Berkeley, where she's also a research professor of law. She was interviewed for the 60 Minutes piece about her research into SECOT, along with the students at the Investigations Lab at University of California, Berkeley. Coming up, another story about journalism, journalist Jasper Nathaniel. He's recently back from the occupied West Bank, where he was documenting Israeli settler and state violence against Palestinians when he himself was attacked by settlers as he tried to document them attacking a woman in her 50s who was there protecting the olive trees. Stay with us.
Me.
Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. As the Israeli cabinet approves another 19 illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank, we look now at Israel's archaeological apartheid. That's the new piece by the New York-based journalist and writer Jasper Nathaniel, who recently returned from the occupied West Bank after months documenting Israeli state and settler violence against Palestinians. He's going to join us in a minute. In October, Jasper Nathaniel was ambushed by settlers as he filmed an attack on Palestinian farmers in the village of Termasiah on the first day of the olive harvest. During the attack, a mass settler Israeli settler wielding a club beat a 55-year-old woman unconscious. She was hospitalized with a brain hemorrhage. This is Afaf Abu Aliya describing being attacked.
We were picking olives, then a vehicle passed by. It kept on going by. Then a woman started screaming, "Settlers," but we didn't see them. They were hiding between the olive trees. She told me, "Settlers, settlers." Then me, my sister-in-law, my brother-in-law, and my son ran away from the area. I was looking around and I saw around 20 settlers, and they started beating me on my head. I fell to the ground and I couldn't feel anything. They continued beating me. I didn't see anyone, and then two people came and carried me.
Jasper Nathaniel and a group of Palestinians were also chased by a swarm of Israeli settlers just before. The settlers were carrying clubs.
Press! Press! American press! American press! Press!
They're literally right behind us. Oh, he's right here. He's about to smash everyone. Oh, here he is. Here he is, Gary. Yeah, there it is. Are the doors locked?
To talk more about this and Israel's de facto annexation of the occupied West Bank, we're joined now by Jasper Nathaniel, New York-based journalist who covers Israel's occupation on his Substack, Infinite Jazz. He's written extensively on state-backed settler violence and Israel's use of archaeology, interestingly, as a tool of annexation. His latest piece is Israel's archaeological apartheid. I want to go back to that day. When was this that this took place, the attack on you and the attack on the woman who was left unconscious?
It was October 19th, so just about 2 months ago.
And explain exactly what happened, how you got to this area, mm-hmm. what you were facing, who you were with.
So it's in a village called Termasiah, which, interestingly, is a 80 to 90% American citizen. Citizens live in this village. And so the reason I mentioned that...
You mean that, U.S. Israeli citizen settlers?
No. Palestinian-American citizens living in this village. So the village is actually largely built on the American economy because a lot of the people who live there go back and forth. They have businesses in the U.S., and then they maintain homes in their ancestral land in Termasiah. So the person that I was with that day, he's a farmer, and he's also an attorney in Anaheim. So, you know, this is important because these people should be protected by the U.S. Embassy, by the State Department, just as much as I should. So basically, the olive fields attached to Termasiah, which belong to the residents there, have been occupied by these really violent settlers over the past couple of months. And anytime farmers have tried to get to their land, they've been attacked. And so this year, for the olive harvest, which is a really important event every year for Palestinians, both because there's a sort of deeper significance to it, but also because it's their livelihood, the olive harvest this year, they decided to all go out together as one group in hopes that they would have protection in numbers, basically. And so I was embedded with the Palestinian farmers on that day, on October 19th. And basically what happened was, as soon as we started driving into the olive fields in a sort of caravan, a settler who I later learned is a sort of infamous leader of the local violent settlers stood in the middle of the road, brandished his pistol, pointed it at us, and was talking on his cell phone. And as he was talking, settlers started appearing behind him. And so we understood, okay, they know we're here, they know we're coming, and they're prepared for us. So the caravan turned around, and we found another way into the olive fields. We were there for a bit. It was not a great harvest this year, mostly because of the weather and climate change. So then when it was time to leave the olive fields, on our way out, we were trapped. There were basically two ways out. One road, there were settlers blocking us. And the other road, there was an Israeli military jeep. And so I was talking to the farmer that I was with, Yasser, and we decided that the safest bet would be for me to actually get out of the car and try to talk to the Israeli soldiers. And
you're a Jewish American.
I'm a Jewish American and a white American, frankly. And the person I was with is a Palestinian American who has brown skin. And so, you know, it's frankly very dangerous to drive towards Israeli soldiers or even to walk towards them. And so we decided, as, you know, the white Jewish American, they were less likely to shoot me, frankly. And so I walked up to the soldiers and I was waving my arms and they were aiming their rifles at me, which is just sort of standard procedure when soldiers talk to you in the West Bank. And I said to them very clearly, we need help getting out of the olive fields because there are settlers blocking us in who are not letting us out. We're just trying to get back into the village of Termessiah. They sort of questioned me. They wanted to know what I was doing there. I think they were kind of confused to see me in the olive fields. And finally, they said, okay, get back in the car and we'll help you get out.
We'll accompany you.
Yes. And so I get in the car with Yasser. We drive up towards them. And as we're driving up, we see that same settler from earlier with the gun standing right next to them. And so again, I stick my head out the window and I say, are you going to help us get by this guy? And they say, yes, yes, just wait a minute. We'll get him out of the way and then we'll go. As soon as they say that, they get back in the car and speed away and leave us alone with this infamously violent settler who is known to the IDF, in part because they collaborate. So we then are thinking, well, this is a dangerous situation. We've just been left alone with this settler. Clearly the soldiers just set us up or something. And he's talking on his cell phone again. But then he's on an ATV. He drives away. And so we think maybe we're okay. There's another Palestinian there in his car, he's been attacked already. So his windshield is smashed, his tires are slashed. And so I get out of the car and I offer to help push him so that he can sort of get to the ridge of the hill and roll back down into town. And as I'm pushing him, that's when this huge mob of dozens of settlers wearing masks, wielding clubs, sort of appear from the hills and start chasing us. So that video that you see was taken by somebody on the other side of the olive fields. So this is literally about 3 or 4 minutes after the IDF soldiers promised us safe passage out of the olive fields.
So you're then, they bring you up there, they desert you, and then suddenly these settlers come. Are they armed?
They were, well, the first guy that we saw had a pistol and he was pointing it at us. To the extent that I was able to get a good look at the mob that was chasing us, they were wielding these huge clubs. And, I think a lot of the time when people see like videos of settler attacks on the internet, it's maybe a couple of settlers who show up and start harassing Palestinians and then there's a confrontation and then they attack. But in this case, it was clear that this was a planned ambush. Again, it was the first day that the Palestinians had gone back into the olive fields that these settlers had occupied. And they showed up basically as an army with these clubs that had clearly been, built as weapons. And they were there. They were out for blood.
They weren't just sticks that they picked up.
Oh, no. I mean, these are I mean, they look like golf clubs almost. I mean, they have these big knots at the end that, we're able to break through our windshields.
So talk about what happened, how you discovered this woman.
So I am running away in that video that you show, and I reach the bottom of the hill.
I'm going to show that video as you talk.
And when I get to the bottom of the hill, Yasser, the guy who I was with before, is down in the car. And he's stuck, though, because now there's basically a bottleneck of cars trying to get out of the olive fields. And I jump into the car, and, this mob is right behind me. One of the settlers, who is sort of out in front, really big guy with a big club, wearing a mask, is right behind us. He smashes through our rear windshield.
With the club.
With the club. 5 or 6 times. And again, we were stuck. And so, I mean, both Yasser and I thought, these guys are going to drag us out of the car. And who knows what's going to happen. And I should say, a couple kilometers away, a 20-year-old Palestinian American, Saifullah Mousalet, was beaten to death by a mob just like this in his olive fields. And so this was sort of on my mind as this was happening, that this is how it happens. The guy smashes through our windshield, and then he actually runs out in front. There's still a huge mob behind him, sort of showering us with rocks and beating cars, lighting cars on fire. And then we see out in front a woman maybe 30 or 40 feet away standing under an olive tree. And she had been there picking olives as, you know, part of the harvest. And the settler just sort of beelines right to her. And, I mean, it was the single most heinous act of violence I've ever witnessed, and I've seen a fair amount in the West Bank. I mean, he clubbed her once, knocked her completely unconscious.
And clubbed her head?
Yes, and then he stood over her body and struck her twice more in the head while she was down. And then the mob kept running, throwing rocks. Yeah, I mean, it was just a full-on attack, basically.
Mm. And how did she survive?
So I got out.
We just played the clip of her in the hospital.
Yeah, so I got out of the car, and there were two other Palestinian guys, and we basically ran to her and helped carry her to safety into another car. And she was rushed to the hospital, in addition to a couple other people who were also severely wounded. And she was in a coma for several days. I mean, she had a brain bleed, and it was touch and go, is my understanding.
So we only have 3 minutes, and I want to make sure we get all aspects of this story in. What did the Israeli government say at that point, and how did the story change?
So immediately, you know, I had obviously filmed it and shared it, and it started to go a bit viral. And the Israeli government immediately put in a statement that the IDF arrived at the scene of a confrontation and dispersed it. And I can just say that that is categorically untrue. Not only did they not arrive, but they were there right before it started, before leaving. And so the Israeli military did absolutely nothing. And then the last thing I'll say is just the next day, I was back in the olive fields, and there was enough outrage that there was a sort of nominal investigation happening on the ground. The soldiers, Israeli soldiers and police officers who were there doing this investigation, were accompanied by the settler with the gun, who we understand to be a leader of the local settlement.
And so what happened when your video got out?
I mean, it drove enough outrage that I think it sort of forced the Israeli authorities to act in some way to you know, act like they are doing something to crack down on this violence. And actually, a couple weeks later, the man who clubbed the woman was actually arrested, but they've, you know, done nothing to dismantle the network of settler terrorists
there. Which brings us to that larger point, how this relates to settler violence in the West Bank and what's happening now with Bezalel Smotrich.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, a little context on what's happening in the West Bank right now and why this is happening is that Smotrich basically pulled off a bureaucratic coup to take over control of West Bank governance and install other settler ideologues who can, you know, run all the bureaucratic processes to approve new settlements, basically. And so what's happening right now is these really violent settlers are going out into the fields. They're stealing land from Palestinians, attacking people. Every once in a while, the Israeli government will condemn them, but then what happens is they turn around and they retroactively legalize the land that was stolen and basically reward the violent settlers by giving them the stamp of state legitimacy. And then, you know, within weeks, months, years, you have a new settlement right there where the violent settlers had, you know, gone out and stolen the land.
We're going to do part two of this conversation and post it online at democracynow.org, where I'm going to ask you about Mohammed Ibrahim, the Palestinian-American teenager released from an Israeli military prison in late November after more than 9 months in custody without trial. Palestinian-American, you've just come from Florida, where you spent time with him. Jasper Nathaniel, New York-based writer and reporter who covers Israel's occupation of the West Bank on his Substack called Infinite Jazz. And we'll talk about your new piece, Israel's Archaeological Apartheid. That does it for our show. A happy birthday to Yusra Rizuki. We have job openings at Democracy Now! For video news production and digital fellowship programs, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
Do you know what your local wetland has done for you lately? Wetlands function like nature's kidneys, mitigating the impacts of floods and droughts, protecting our communities, and supporting food production. Despite representing 6% of the Earth's surface, wetlands store 33% of the planet's carbon. If you value life, thank a wetland. Learn about wetlands at work with Ducks Unlimited Canada at ducks.ca/wetlands.